Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, we booked the Secretary of State on today's show.
We did.
How about that?
Secretary of State.
Pod Save the America losers.
Yeah, good job. Good booking, guys.
You guys will get to hear from Secretary of State Tony Blinken later in the show. We talked to Tony about the Iran deal, his trip to Ukraine. He probably is on the plane by now. He was leaving right after we recorded. We talked about how our political problems at home are impacting his work abroad, combating anti-Semitism, some lighter stuff about being a dad, being a musician. Fun conversation.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we both cover some important issues, but also, you know, get a little bit more sense of the Secretary of State.
The man, the myth, the legend.
The man, the legend, yeah.
Tony's like the nicest guy in the world.
It's funny. Yeah, yeah.
He's from out here. I remember walking into a hotel, Shutters in Santa Monica, just seeing him hanging out a couple years ago.
Yeah, he was out here when he had his first kid, which was pretty cool. It feels about 700 years ago.
A million years ago.
He actually did a Pod Save the World ride-along in the studio.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, back when that was also possible.
It was a blast.
Yeah.
When everyone could speak freely. Our news section today, Ben, I was thinking we could just spend 45 minutes walking through all the ways the Buffalo Bills humiliated my New England Patriots.
Yeah,
do you think that would go over well?
Yeah, the cold weather didn't really help you guys. I remember we talked about that last week.
Nothing helped us. Yeah. Nothing. Josh Allen had more touchdowns than incompletions. So that's all you need to know. Yale Fried, who's one of our great video producers here at Crooked Media, he was trolling me so hard during the game that he got his dad involved on Twitter. So it was nice to have sort of a generational ass kicking from my friends in Buffalo. But they also, Yale does this great series that we started called Tommy Gets Red Pilled on YouTube. It's been very fun where they torture
me
with right wing content.
Don Jr.
Yeah, so we did the Warren Christmas and we did Don Jr.'s Instagram. And their goal is to trigger me over the course of an hour until I'm beat red and angry by the end. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. Then we try to combat some disinformation. That's sort of the point of the show.
Yeah.
So check it out. But what we're really going to talk about today is Ukraine, how Silicon Valley views human rights, including in China, updates on Boris Johnson and Djokovic, the tennis player, the eruption in Tonga, Twitter in Nigeria, and then the interview with Tony. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it's no shortage of stuff happening out there in the world.
Busy. So before we get to the news, don't miss the latest episode of Offline with Jon Favreau. Jon's digging into all the ways that social media is changing the ways we all engage or don't engage with new ideas. Not entirely helpful all the time. Offline drops Sunday on the Pod Save America feed. Great episode this week. Don't miss it. Also this week on America Dissected, Abdul El-Sayed talks with Tom Friedan, the former director of the CDC, about the pandemic and the future of the organization. Is he the really tall guy, Tom Friedan?
Yeah, he was the guy who was there during Ebola. He was good.
Yeah, I remember, I think I was with him in, I remember like getting on like a dinghy and driving out to a Coast Guard cutter in Haiti with him.
The problem for me is that everybody seems like a really, you seem like a really tall guy, Tommy, because I'm a really short guy.
There was someone who was like 6'7". Yeah, yeah. And I remember like being on a boat, this guy not being able to see over his shoulders. It's all a blur.
Yeah, yeah. That was a long time ago, too.
Whatever. Okay. So let's talk Ukraine. You guys are going to hear us talk about kind of like bigger considerations with Tony and like step back a little bit. But here's a quick roundup of recent events, and they're all bad. There are reports that Russia is evacuating the spouses and children of its diplomats currently serving in Ukraine. So they're all getting on buses and literally just going east for 15 hours back to Russia. So that's quite ominous. There was a massive cyber attack against Ukraine that took down about 70 government websites. No surprise, the Ukrainian government says Russia is responsible for it. The U.S. accused Russia of planning covert false flag operations in eastern Ukraine to create a pretext for an invasion. So the idea here is that Russia sends in some operatives. They stage attacks, maybe even on their own proxy forces. That gives Putin the pretext to literally roll in the tanks and invade. Russia's deputy foreign minister said he wouldn't rule out putting military infrastructure in Cuba or Venezuela. Ben, you can smell the like 1960s like pipe tobacco and wool suits coming off this one. You know, it's a very Kennedy Cuban Missile Crisis. The Polish foreign minister said that the risk of war in Europe is now greater than ever before in the last 30 years. In the White House, the briefing on Tuesday, Jen Psaki said, quote, "We believe we're now at a stage where Russia could at any point launch an attack on Ukraine." So every indicator seems to be trending in a bad direction. It is hard to avoid the feeling that we are slow rolling into a major war. am I wrong? Are you seeing anything positive side of ledger?
No, I mean, the mood music out there, Tommy, is pointing entirely in one direction. You know, I mean, the couple other things I'd throw into this, there are Russian forces moving into Belarus for what they say are military exercises, but that, you know, usefully further encircles Ukraine with Russian military forces. And you hear nothing positive at all about any follow-up to all the diplomacy that took place over the last couple of weeks. That seems to be kind of dead in the water. Mm-hmm. And yeah, everything that has happened for a period of months now has been a steady escalation up to a logical endpoint of some Russian invasion of Ukraine. I mean, I, and this, make no mistake, would be, you know, a cataclysmic event potentially. Now, again, part of what we've talked about here that is so complicated in a way is that, you know, Russia's been at war with Ukraine since 2014. They've occupied parts of eastern Ukraine. They've annexed Crimea. So in some ways, it feels like, well, isn't this just a continuation of what has been a status quo? I think what we don't know the answer to, though, is what form would an invasion of Ukraine take?
Yeah.
And I think what's most worrying to me is, you know, it'd be bad enough if they just moved overwhelming force into the two provinces of eastern Ukraine that they currently occupy, Luhansk and Donetsk. These are provinces with, you know, large Russian-speaking populations. And so the pretext for Russia back in 2014 was they had to defend the rights of these people. This is where most of the fighting has been. And obviously it would be a significant geopolitical escalation to try to maybe formally annex those parts of Ukraine into Russia. But I think what's so worrying is the scale of this buildup and the speed with which diplomacy collapsed because Russia's objectives were so out of the bounds of anything the United States could agree to. And the rhetoric coming out of Russia, tapping into even if you look at some of the Russian propaganda, the kind of history of Russia and Ukraine being one country, you know, feels like something much bigger. It feels like a potential kind of full-on invasion of Ukraine, the country, an effort to kind of completely undo the post-Soviet status quo of these being independent sovereign states. And, you know, we could be looking at something that is just of a different scale than even something that we saw in 2014 on the current trajectory of events. And it's hard to see what is going to derail that train, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if they get to Kiev, the capital, they've cut off half the country. And you also have to wonder what this does to countries like Georgia, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Finland, who are on that same border and wondering, like, are we next? Is anyone going to stand up for us? I mean, some NATO countries will obviously feel a different way than non-NATO countries, but it is frightening.
Yeah, and I think part of what's frightening, too, is in 2014, again, it's just kind of worth doing a bit of history. What happened was a pro-Russian corrupt leader, Yanukovych, fled Ukraine in the face of mass protests. And then the Russians kind of, in response or maybe opportunistically, did this kind of de facto invasion of Crimea with like special forces and changing the facts on the ground very swiftly. And that felt like an extension of these events that were happening. Right.
Right? This feels senseless.
This feels like,
why is he doing this?
Putin made a decision and he deployed 100+ thousand troops to the border and then invaded a country. Not to be hyperbolic, because there's an overuse of World War II analogies, but this feels a little bit more like the 30s, like a leader being like, I don't care about world opinion at all. I'm going to do this in a methodical way with a propaganda pretext to it. And you see a lot of that coming out of Russia with obviously a militarism to it and with an objective. And the objective is to essentially undo the core dissolution of the Soviet Union. And we talked last week about the greater sway he has over Kazakhstan, Putin does now, Belarus, which he's basically turned into a client. But you mentioned this, you know, Moldova and Georgia are also former Soviet republics that have an uncomfortable Russian presence. Mm-hmm. What's next for them? You know, if there's a, if this train gets going and there's momentum behind it, you know, you could see a situation in which several countries are somehow immersed in this conflagration. And, you know, the flip side for Russia is, you know, there's no easy military task to, like, conquer Ukraine, you know. So once a war begins, it can lead in directions almost always that, that none of the parties anticipate, you know.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about whataboutism and foreign policy in a minute and the limits of it and how frustrating it can be in debates. But I couldn't help but think, as we were, you know, listening to possible U.S. responses to a Russian invasion, the United States overtly talking about basically funding and arming an insurgency. This comes after 20 years, well, not 20 years in Iraq, but a decade plus in Iraq, where we were fighting against an insurgency funded in part by Iran. History goes further back. In Afghanistan, we supported an insurgency to repel the Russians. It's just like all of this stuff keeps repeating itself. None of it seems to benefit anyone involved. It's hard not to feel sort of despondent at the moment.
Well, it does. It feels like there's this moment where the Putins of the world are just going to, you know, at some point, this kind of ethno-nationalism on steroids, which is what we've lived through for the last decade globally, spills into actual conflicts, yeah. You know, and that's part of what's so scary. I'm not one of these people that believes in the, like, reverse domino theory credibility thing, like,
no.
Because the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan. But there is something else to be worried about, which is that it's less about, like, the perception of the U.S. and Afghanistan and more just about, do all these nationalist leaders start making their play? You know, like, you got Xi Jinping with Taiwan. You've got, you know, all manner of border conflicts that have festered for a while. And, you know, we could be ushering in, like, a very unstable period of time here. I think you got to try whatever you can. I hope that they're continuing to try to exhaust diplomatic efforts. I hope that you know, I would actually be glad if, you know, there were efforts that we didn't know about that, you know, Biden is undertaking with Putin to try to forestall this. I also think that at a certain point, we talked to Tony about this. We try to step back and get at, why is this important? What is the broader context within which this is occurring? And Tony's been out there a lot on this. I frankly think this something that, like, we're going to have to hear from Biden on at some point,
yeah,
too.
Definitely.
Because, you know, unless everything we're seeing takes a pretty dramatic turn, swerve in a different direction, something that feels like it's been a kind of back burner, secondary issue can really be the dominant thing in global politics for the foreseeable future.
Oh, absolutely. And associated, like, economic impacts and,
yeah.
You know, it's going to spin out. Okay, let's talk about human rights in China, because yesterday a video circulated on Twitter of a billionaire investor named Chamath Palihapitiya, who this video just triggered me into the fucking stratosphere, Ben. This clip was from a podcast he hosts with a bunch of other, like, super rich Silicon Valley investor types. Here's the clip that went around Twitter.
Nobody cares about. Nobody cares about what's happening to the Uyghurs. Okay, you bring it up because you really
what?
Care, and I think
what
that's nice that
cares?
You care. The rest of us don't care. I'm just
well,
telling
really
you a very
care?
Hard.
Wait,
I'm
you're
telling
saying you
very,
personally don't care.
I'm telling you a very hard, ugly truth. Okay, of all the things that I care about, yes, it is below my line. Okay, of all the things that I care about, it is below my line.
What's the line, bro? I mean, if genocide is below it, I don't quite know what rises above the line.
Real nuanced issue, yeah. Genocide. Yeah. Now, in case you're wondering if this clip was somehow taken out of context and unfair, I'm here to tell you that I listened to the whole conversation and it got worse.
Did you red pill to listen to that thing?
I know. Chamath was just making, like, a political observation that, generally speaking, voters don't care about human rights, so they don't care about the Uyghurs. They don't care about foreign policy issues when they vote. I would concede part of that depressing point. Yes, there are more front burner things. They focus on what's happening in their neighborhood, their pocketbook, et cetera. But his argument was way beyond that. He was saying he doesn't personally care about the Uyghurs. He was saying that caring about human rights is a luxury belief in the U.S. until we clean up our act at home, that talking about the Uyghurs is just virtue signaling. He even questioned, was sort of, like, skeptical when his co-host, this guy, Jason Calcanis, who's some investor guy, who's actually really great in pushing back and pushing for human rights as being important. But when Jason was saying there's a million Uyghurs being held in concentration camps, he was, like, kind of skeptical, right? Like, throughout, he was doing the bit where conceding that he doesn't know what he's talking about, has no expertise in the issue, but kind of casting doubt on every factual claim by someone who actually knows what he's talking about and is well informed. And it was very frustrating. And in this conversation, no one on the show brought up the fact that, you know, maybe this guy, Chamath, owns a small stake in the Golden State Warriors, the NBA team, and maybe his reticence to talk about China or criticize China is driven by money, because the Chinese government kicks the shit out of anyone who criticizes them on human rights and silences them. So that would have been worth raising. But, you know, there's all this like nihilism dressed up as savvy and whataboutism about how like the U.S. is bad and we have no standing to criticize others, and just infuriating.
Well, one other thing, how did he make his money? Chamath
investing in like some firm called Social Capital, yeah, where they claim to be doing something for a greater good.
Yeah.
And like he kept getting presented, like the right wing picked this up and they got mad at him because he was seen as someone who was a liberal. And frankly, I think the viewpoints you heard on this podcast are more representative of the Silicon Valley mindset than this sort of tired suggestion that it's full of liberals. Like, yes, socially, the younger people are liberal, but I think these guys are focused on making money in capitalism. And just to put a fine point on it, you know, they're talking about what they stand for. At the very end, Chamath says, "I stand for me." That was kind of his concluding point. So he got destroyed for these comments on Twitter. He eventually sort of apologized. But what I thought might be useful to listeners is to like talk about this issue more broadly, but also talk about how to push back on this kind of whataboutism. Because you hear this all the time, Ben. And like, people who try to tell you that the America has no standing to talk about human rights or call out human rights violations by China or name your country, it becomes this one-stop shop excuse for throwing up your hands at problems, saying you have no agency, shutting down people who actually try to care. And, you know, look, I've been talking for a while. So I'll just pause before like sort of suggesting some ways I think we can push back. But if you have any thoughts on like, I don't know, this kind of conversation or this mindset that no one cares about human rights, that we can't even talk about it because our own house is in order. Like, I don't know, this sort of general offensiveness of it all.
I think there's two things that stand out to me. And what I was getting at is, how did he make his money? So he was also an executive at Facebook, right?
Yes, that too. Forgot about that.
And so the first point is there is this kind of libertarian streak in Silicon Valley that, frankly, it's not just unique to Silicon Valley. It permeates a lot of the American corporate culture that essentially says, you know, my own profit, my own innovation is inherently somehow a good, no matter how much harm it does to other people.
They literally, you know, say later in this interview, one other guy is like, I think the way we solve this is through technology and innovation and more speech. And it's like, guys, we just tried this.
Yeah. And you know, you've had a lot of people making a lot of money not giving a shit what the outcome of what they do is, whether that is Facebook spreading the cancer of hate speech and disinformation and conspiracy theory around the world, or whether that is just pouring money into parts of the Chinese system that are being repurposed for mass surveillance and internment of people, right? And if you want to get at the whataboutism, do some reading about what's happening to the Uyghurs, right? This is a systematic oppression on a scale that you cannot wrap your mind around, right? It can be a lot worse, right? And this leads to the second point, which is the idea that Americans don't really care about foreign policy or human rights it's a nice talking point, and it may on the surface level be true, but like, we just opened the show by talking about the fact that there could be a war in Europe because
it's worth caring about
the same kind of ideology, the same kind of ethno-nationalist fascistic ideology that could lead someone to think that they can invade a country, that could lead them to think that they can interfere in our politics and our elections, that could lead them to be spreading, as Russia does, a lot of the anti-vax garbage that is prolonging the pandemic in this country and other places. This ends up hurting you in the long run, you know, in the same way that if we live in a world in which increasingly a kind of merger of American-made technology and Chinese-style autocracy could really be the future of how societies are organized. I mean, you don't care about it until you're forced to care about it when it comes comes home, right? And the United States has always been an imperfect messenger on this. But if you actually talk to people who are on the front lines of the battles for human rights, like they need America to at least try to be its better self and to at least try to live up to the stories we tell about who we are and the stories we tell about democracy and human rights and people being created equal. And if you don't think that matters to people, like the reason, say, the Cold War ended the way that it did, you know, yes, America was full of hypocrisy throughout the Cold War. But the reality is, like, people felt like there were enough other people around the world who cared about freedom and democracy to sacrifice for it on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And people thought that freedom and openness looked like a more attractive option by the time you got to the late 80s than what they were living with. And that created untold prosperity for the American people, right? The end of the successful end of the Cold War, the opening of markets, et cetera. It made it possible for people like these guys on this kind of bro investor pod to get rich, you know, to the extent that they have. So I'm like, why we're still having a debate in 2022 about whether the survivability of democracy and human rights matters to people, I think speaks to why we're in the fucking mess that we're in. You know, like it, like these things should be taken as a given, and they're not anymore. And that sucks.
Yeah, I mean, listen, people don't care about any issue until you convince them to care or inform them about it. That's yeah. True for foreign and domestic. Like the anti-abortion activism is a relatively modern creation. You know, the religious right organized and activated in this country, and it became a massive voting issue. And with respect to the Uyghurs, you can see the camps that were built from space.
Yeah.
You know, there are videos from inside the re-education camps. Like the BBC was let in there. Some of the most haunting things you've ever seen, like YouTube them, buddy. There are interviews with survivors. Like there's no doubting that there's a genocide occurring in China. And it's just frustrating to hear someone question that. And there's a real strain of this on the left that's particularly frustrating, I think, because they worry that it's a pretext for war. But I think, you know, that's part of what we have to get at with this sort of like rejection of whataboutism. I just think people, like, broadly, when you hear these kinds of arguments, like the first thing, it's like reject this false choice that we have to choose about caring about like human rights in Xinjiang, China, or, you know, domestic rights in the US. Like we have to do both. And in fact, getting our act together at home helps us, you know, talk about human rights abroad, right? Like that's the first thing. I think we also all just need to reject outright the idea that human rights or democracy promotion means Bush era wars. I get why that's triggering for people and they think that, but no one is arguing that we should go to war with China. This is about like speaking up, pressure at international fora like the UN or other places, like embarrassing them.
Divesting,
yeah, right, on yeah. individual level divesting. And then just lastly, like, I hate when people assume they're powerless in these situations. Like, I don't think for one second that I, like, the Chinese government gives a fuck what I think. But how many times have we talked about protest movements, individual activists that have started movements that have swollen to the point of like toppling governments? Like, a guy just got elected in Chile, who was a, you know, started in the streets as a protester. So, you know, like if you try at scale, like your voice can matter and you can make a difference. And when people who are big, like rich, influential people like these investors sort of say, no one cares, it's not worth caring, it's not on my like list of things, I think that's actually damaging for people to hear.
Yeah, I think, you know, number one, it matters because it fucking matters to the Chinese Communist Party. If it didn't matter to them, why would they go to such lengths to intimidate people to not speak out about this
stuff? Right.
Like, secondly, I've talked to people. I talked to somebody today who's in a significant risk, who's an activist in another country. Every conversation you have with someone who's actually endangered, they always tell you how much it matters to them that people in other countries care, because otherwise they're just alone. What the hell are they doing? Like, otherwise they're insane, right? Yeah, for caring and sacrificing. If you can't even show that basic ounce of solidarity with the people that are on the front lines of these fights, then you're pulling the rug out from under them. The last thing I'd say about this is, you know, connecting it to the domestic politics piece, I think an insight on the Republican side is that none of this is about issues. It's all about identity, right? So, like, Trumpism isn't about any set of policies. It's all about identity. Foreign policy is an extension of their domestic identity politics around white ethno-nationalism. And we have to have a sense of identity that is actually proud of values, mm-hmm. right? Like, it can't just be negative. It can't just be like, oh, these people are killing democracy. There has to be a democracy worth saving, you know?
Right.
And so, like, it's time to actually once again be unafraid and unabashed in making the argument for values, even if America's, like, not lived up to them, and even if we have to point out all the ways in which America is not living up to them. Because right now, and I asked Tony this question, the momentum is so overwhelmingly with this other story that's a shitty story. Like, the ethno-nationalist story, it ends horribly, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. It never ended well in history, right? Nope. Like, but if we're, like, in this defensive crouch constantly, and we're cowed by whataboutism, and we're cowed by not wanting to lose Chinese market share, or whatever the fucking excuses we have on a given day to not care about these things, then you know that you will lose.
Absolutely. And so let's actually stick with this sort of question of technology and human rights overlapping, because after 7 months, the Nigerian government has finally lifted its ban on Twitter. The government suspended Twitter on June 4th after the company deleted a post by Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari that was deemed to be threatening. He referenced like a civil war from the 70s, I believe. It was very scary. To get back in business, Twitter agreed to open an office in Nigeria, comply with tax laws, and respect local Nigerian laws, basically. The pretty significant concessions by Twitter that some analysts think could change how the service is used in Nigeria. You know, famously back in 2020, Twitter was a key critical organizing tool around the End SARS protest movement. It was this section of the police that were incredibly brutal, that were indiscriminately killing people. And young people in Nigeria organized around that hashtag very effectively. It's not clear that that kind of organizing would be allowed under the new rules. You could see the government saying it's against the law. That said, you know, not having access to Twitter without a VPN was really hard on mostly young Nigerians who love Twitter and use it for, like, to find jobs, missing people, to have debates. Like, they use it in all these different ways. It's not like us who use it to, like, shit post and, you know, quote tweet.
Quote tweet.
Like, I guess it was.
I don't know what I could ever do without quote tweet.
I don't either. I guess, like, you know, time will tell which way this goes, right? Whether the Nigerian government benefits, whether Twitter caved too early, whether people are actually getting a service back that they really need. But did you have a sense, Ben, of like what you thought the impact might be, not just for Twitter users in Nigeria, but also, like, I don't know, whether there might be a path here for other governments that want to regulate social media or kind of bend companies to their will when, you know, powerful figures, in this case, the president, get criticized?
I think the reason this matters is that, look, there's some places where it's pretty clear that platforms like Twitter are not going to be able to survive. I mean, they're already not in China, for instance, mm-hmm. and more repressive and closed societies, you know, are going to have less and less of a place for American social media platforms. Nigeria is one of these places, though, that is a relatively open society. It is a democracy, albeit one with a lot of problems. So are we. And so the question is, what does a platform like Twitter look like in the long run in those places? I think it's inevitable that, you know, look, any local regulator has a right to take some interest in it. The question is, in practice, does that stifle the sense of openness on the platform or not? And so it'll be an interesting test. You know, if the idea that they're going to have more of a presence in Nigeria and be more tuned to what's happening in Nigeria, I think is a good thing, right? I mean, a lot of these companies run kind of almost on autopilot from Silicon Valley and have these huge consequences in these other countries. And so I think it's not wrong to have a greater expectation that they're more attuned and plugged into what's happening in a place. The question is, at what point does that become censorship? And I think, or censorship that kind of undermines the kind of core tenet of the platform. And look, everybody's wrestling with this everywhere. I think that's all the more reason for the United States and other countries to try to come together on a multilateral basis. And actually, I put this question to Tony too, but like, we should get ahead of this regulation question. Mm-hmm. These platforms are so unregulated that gap is going to be filled by every individual country. And I think what you need is some kind of common principles, norms, standards, regulations that a bunch of countries are entering into together, so that you don't have this kind of massively unregulated, you know, from a domestic standpoint in the U.S. set of technology companies that then, you know, have a different regulatory framework everywhere they're operating.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable, but the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
Okay, let's turn to an issue that is a little lighter, a little more fun, that I can't get enough of on social media, which has been Boris Johnson literally can't stop partying. I have lost count of the number of parties hosted by Boris or by the Tory party during lockdown that I don't know which ones he attended anymore, which ones he's denied, like what lie goes there. So last week, Boris Johnson apologized to Parliament for attending a garden party in May of 2020. Again, May of 2020.
Like the most half-assed apology.
Yeah, during lockdown. He tried to claim that he thought it was a work event, right? He's like, oh, I went out for 25 minutes. 25 minutes isn't a short period of time.
Yeah.
You could probably identify that this was a party by all the boozing that happens in 25 minutes. Number 10 also apologized to Buckingham Palace for a staff party that Boris apparently didn't go to, that went down the day before the Queen was forced to attend her husband's funeral and sit alone by herself. That's tough timing for everyone involved.
I think that if I had gone to a party with 25 people in May of 2020, I would have fucking been aware of it.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was locked in my house all the time.
Oh, it would have been sweet.
So it wasn't like a normal thing where you wander out and this is like peak lockdown. Like, you think you'd be aware that this is unusual, that I'm around all these people drinking without masks and, you know, hanging out.
Oh, yeah. If I accidentally spent a half an hour at a rager with 40 people in a backyard with wine, I'd be psyched in May of 2020.
Yeah, yeah, seriously. I mean, there's just like an insult to people's intelligence
that
flows from the way in which Boris has handled all this. And like, he can't undo the manifold original sins that add up to this scandal. And so like, he's just a permanently damaged political figure, right? He will never be seen in the same way after this. And he will never resign because he's that full of himself. If he proves me wrong, that's great. And the conservatives don't know how to toss him overboard because they made their deal with the devil. So it's just watching a lot of people getting their comeuppance because they had to party.
Yeah. And so, okay, making this more complicated for Boris is the fact that his former aide, this guy Dominic Cummings, who was like the Karl Rove of Brexit or whatever bullshit before he got pushed out, he's out there saying now, he's writing on his blog, his Substack, that Boris is a liar. Cummings says he warned Boris not to let the party happen. He told him it was against the rules, but then Boris Johnson let it happen anyway, which would mean that Johnson just brazenly lied to Congress saying he was unaware of this, he didn't attend, blah, blah, blah. Ben, here's what Boris had to say in response to these latest allegations from Dominic Cummings.
No, nobody told me that what we were doing was, as you say, against the rules, that the event in question was something that we were going to do something that wasn't a work event.
So, philosophical question for you. If you write the rules, do you need someone to tell you what the rules are?
Yeah, I mean, then, you know, if he truly didn't realize that they were in lockdown in May of 2020, then that's another reason to get rid of him. I mean, I think the Queen part bears repeating if I was like Labour.
Uh-huh.
If this guy, if the Queen of England, right? Like, one of the most, whatever you think of the monarchy, like, you know, this is like an office that, let's just say, has generally been pretty high up on the food chain.
Her in particular.
In the United Kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. If she's going to the funeral of the person she was married to for like 100 years and is sitting alone, and the go look at the picture.
It's
wearing a mask, and there's nobody within like 100 feet of this woman.
It's a little lady.
If the rules apply to the queen of the United Kingdom that you are the prime minister of, and you either don't know the rules or think you can break the rules, maybe it's time to resign, okay?
Here's how a resignation might be pushed upon him. So for, I think this is from our friend Mark Landler in the New York Times. For Johnson to be forced out, 54 conservative lawmakers would have to write to Graham Brady, the chairman of the 1922 committee, what the hell is that name, which represents the Tory backbenchers. They can call for a vote of no confidence. And then Johnson would have to survive a majority vote among all 361 conservative lawmakers to fully survive. Then I think he would have a basically a 12-month reprieve where he couldn't be challenged again. So I don't know. All of this happens in private. We'll see. But you could... A few people are breaking away from Boris.
People are breaking. I mean, if they go into the next election with Boris as the leader, you know, I know the guy's been slippery in the past, but it feels like they kind of get walloped. You'd need a bunch of people to get together and decide to put their hands on the knife together. And that probably would involve one person making a run at being the leader. And Boris has sucked up so much oxygen that that is more difficult for them. I don't really shed a tear for the Tories in this scenario at all. I do think when we laugh at other people's arcane procedural rules, keep in mind that like the rest of the world is probably like, what's this filibuster?
Yeah, you know? That's right. The 1922 committee sounds goofy. We have, yeah. What's a filibuster? Favorite party movie from you? Can't Hardly Wait, Dazed and Confused, Super Bad, House Party. You got a vote. Animal House.
That must be canceled, Animal House.
I don't know.
Did you just do it?
Did you just cancel it right here?
No, because I mean,
shit, you're out.
Like I haven't seen it in a while.
You're out, Belushi.
I remember really liking it. I was gonna say favorite party movie. You know what? Like Dazed and Confused. You know, I was in like high school, and that was like the movie that, like, if you had to stay home on like Saturday and have some people over, like mm-hmm. throw on Dazed and Confused. You know. You'd like rip a bong hit and like,
oh yeah,
you know,
vintage McConaughey.
Yeah. Vintage McConaughey. Kind of an all-star cast.
Oh, absolutely. Except for the kid who plays the young guy who no one really heard from again. The one who touches his nose all the time.
Yeah. I'd say Dazed and Confused.
Great. Why not? Great flick.
Yeah. Linklater. You know.
All right. Let's talk about another conservative asshole who's in a bit of trouble here, which is Novak Djokovic. So after his 11-day fight with the Australian government, tennis star Novak Djokovic was deported from Australia on January 16th, and he will not get to play in the Australian Open. We covered the backstory of this in greater detail last week, but the short version is Djokovic is unvaccinated. He went to Australia anyway, thinking he would get an exemption from their rules requiring visitors to be vaccinated. He lied on his immigration or visa forms. His visa got revoked, it got returned, it got revoked again, and generally it was a huge mess. At the end of the day, Australians who sacrificed a lot during this pandemic were in no mood to grant an exemption to this celebrity who had shown total disregard for others. Scott Morrison, Australia's prime minister, cheered the decision. He's generally a hardliner in all things immigration, as we discussed last week, kind of a shitty guy, reportedly took a shit in in his pants in McDonald's bathroom in the late 90s, just an aside. Ben, probably right around when Can't Hardly Wait came out. Ben, what do you make of the argument that the reasoning behind Djokovic's eventual deportation, basically that like Australians could see him, anti-vaxxers could try to emulate his disregard for COVID rules and, you know, sort of like, I don't know, like get some wind in their sails because of his actions, that was a threat to public safety. Some activists are saying that sets a terrible precedent and it could actually be used to suppress legitimate political speech in the future that's inconvenient for the ruling power.
Yeah, I mean, we took our shots at Scott Morrison last week because, yeah, he deserves it in general. But I think if you follow this all the way to the end, it felt to me like the better argument and the one that, you know, ultimately he lost is that he just broke the rules.
Right.
And he, you know, the forms weren't accurate. He wasn't vaccinated and he didn't have his shit together. And if you break the rules, you don't get to play. That's a better rationale than, you know, this kind of example setting, which can be repurposed in bad ways. I have a world, though, take on this that is probably lame, but I'm going to do it anyway, which
Please.
Is, so Djokovic gets defeated by Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who's up next?
The French.
France. if France doesn't stand up to Djokovic, it's like AUKUS 2.0. Right? Like, once again.
It's your second AUKUS name drop today. You did it to Sony too.
Once again, you have an Aussie flex followed by a French, you know, like, so let's see. Let's see what you got, Macron.
So you're saying to Macron,
balls in your court.
Balls in your court.
Balls in your court. Just, I'm giving this away.
That's good.
Away for free.
The French Open's in May.
So Djokovic either gets a shot or Macron has to see whether he can be as tough as the Australians.
That's good. That's good. It's worth noting that a recent poll found that 71% of Australians wanted Djokovic to get the boot. So the politics here are pretty obvious. Serbia, where Djokovic is from, is big time pissed.
Yeah.
They're like lighting up buildings with his name on them. They're denouncing the Australians. So yeah, that'll probably.
Serbian nationalism also tends not to end well.
Nothing bad. Yeah. Nothing bad ever happened there. Okay, well, we'll have to keep monitoring that one. Another story that I think caught literally everyone's eye over the weekend was the undersea volcano in the South Pacific island that erupted about 40 miles south of the island of Tonga. The eruption was so massive that you could see the mushroom cloud and shockwave it generated from space. Never seen anything like that in my life.
Yeah, it looked like Deep Impact.
It really did. It looked like a movie. Yeah. Terrifying. It created a tsunami wave that apparently in the sort of island nation of Tonga, it's like 170 islands all together, was nearly 50 feet tall. Hard to imagine anything more terrifying than a 50-foot wave coming at you. It devastated villages. It swept around the world. I saw reports. I mean, like, we all woke up in LA, like, don't go near the ocean, tsunami warning, and it was like a foot wave. But there were reports that in Peru, there was an oil spill and two deaths associated with tsunami waves. So that's wild. The islands in Tonga are now covered with this thick volcanic ash. It's fouling water supplies. It's been hard to figure out what the scale of the destruction was because communication was cut off for a couple of days. Another added complication is the fact that Tonga has these pretty strict quarantine rules. They've managed to keep COVID out because they're an island, and rescue organizations don't want to deploy staff until they are requested. So Ben, I don't know, man, it was a pretty horrifying thing. Stories like this for me, though, are a reminder that I spend a lot of my life worrying about pretty pedestrian matters. And then, like, every once in a while, someone will share a link about like super volcanoes or something like that that makes you realize that you're kind of a puny weak species.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that the Earth doesn't really care about your politics or any decisions we're making.
Facts don't care about your feelings.
Yeah, the volcanoes and the climate change and the rest of it, the tsunamis, like, don't really care. I mean, it's also a reminder that, frankly, we need, given how short our attention spans are, that, like, this kind of stuff happens relatively frequently. You know, I mean, it was not that long ago that we had a massive tsunami that killed 250,000 people. You know, that was less than 20 years ago, less than 15 years ago, right? Or that we had
the Bush administration. It was like late Bush administration.
Yeah, or Fukushima, the tsunami that, you know, killed a lot of Japanese people and caused like a potential nuclear meltdown. It is like worth bearing in mind that one reason why it'd be better if nations could work together on things is that we're going to be periodically dealing with this. I mean, what's your favorite disaster? I mean, you've got Armageddon. You've got Deep Impact. You've got Independence Day.
2012. That's when everything gets cold. I think Armageddon is really in the top of the canon.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a nostalgia thing. You know, Affleck, Aerosmith.
Yeah. That stage Affleck. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The little the animal
big
crackers.
Big Affleck. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't close your eyes, fall asleep, miss a thing kind of stuff.
It's good. It's good. Good album.
Yeah. Anyway. Scary story.
Scary story. But I felt bad. I mean, the images from Tonga were pretty horrifying. And, you know, I'm sure that they're going to need a lot of help in rebuilding and attention spans are going to move on. So hopefully there's a donor community internationally that stays focused on it.
Listen, you mentioned Fukushima. I've been reading Reaganland for like a year now.
Yeah, I'm like halfway through. Referencing that for a while.
I know. Now we're at right around the 3 Mile Island. Sort of almost disaster when there was real concern that there was going to be a nuclear meltdown and the way that impacted the energy debate and policy in this country and, you know, exacerbated a whole set of anxieties that were already pretty high because there were gas lines and fuel shortages at places and prices were going up and Jimmy Carter's like blaming consumers and it was just a total mess.
And the, you know, if you look at Fukushima though, that's part of what prompted Germany to get off nuclear, which is complicated their climate targets. So these things have
and Nord Stream and
knockoff and Nord Stream 2.
Brings us to today.
So these things all, you know, it's all connected, right?
It's all connected. Final topic. And this one has the metaverse buzzing. On Monday, the Italian Senate hosted a hearing on transparency and open data in government. Not sure if you saw this one. It included politicians, economists, IT specialists, and even a Nobel Prize winning physicist. It's a big deal. But despite all those big brains, despite all this expertise, someone managed to crash their Zoom feed or like whatever, I don't know, Teams, whatever they use, and start airing 3D animated pornography featuring a character from the Final Fantasy VII video game. I'm not familiar with the Final Fantasy canon, but I know it's popular. Here's my question, Ben. How does that go down in 2022? I was a huge fan of like the Zoom bomb video genre in early COVID, you know, like some really hilarious kid at a high school does something funny and fucks with their teacher. But at this point, like, every elementary school teacher on the planet can click out of that stuff like instantly. Like what gives here? Inside job?
I mean, I'm going to go inside job on this one. I was not prepped for this and I have no place to go other than some grudging admiration
for whoever did it.
Yeah.
I have some branding for you. Boonga Boonga Zoom.
Yeah. I mean, let's just say, like, we talked about arcane parliamentary deliberations before. I mean, this is one way to liven things up.
Maybe this is what happens when you all of a sudden there's like a white nationalist five-star party, a bunch of fucking jokers in there.
Yeah.
Part of this process.
Yeah. Italian politics has always been, a bit crazy. This definitely elevates it to a different level.
Wonder which one of these we're going to do for our Snapchat show, which you all should check out. It's very fun. It's very funny. We pick an issue a week. We could do the Italian Senate. We could do Boris Johnson. We could do, I don't know, the Uyghurs again.
Yeah.
Maybe tweet at us.
Yeah.
Vote.
Tweet at us.
Let us know what you think.
Yeah. The Secretary of State.
Could also do that. See how that cuts down. Speaking of Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we will have our interview with Tony Blinken, Secretary of State. So stick around for that. We are thrilled to welcome onto the show today the Secretary of State, our friend or former colleague, Tony Blinken. Tony, it's great to see you.
Tommy, great to be with you. Great to be with you, Ben. Great to see you guys.
I wore a shirt with a collar, Tony. I hope you noticed that. That's rare.
I was actually going to note that, Ben. I really take that as a sign of deep respect.
Yes,
so thank you.
Respect for you and the office, sir.
Yeah, my hair is barely dry from the shower. In fact, it's not. Tony, we know you're going to go to Ukraine later today, and I think Ben wants to ask about that, but I was going to start with a quick Iran question. I know you're closely monitoring these talks in Vienna, Austria, where diplomats are trying to figure out a way to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, something near and dear to our hearts, and prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. The latest reports are that Iran wants a guarantee from the U.S. that the United States won't unilaterally quit the agreement and reimpose sanctions like President Trump did in 2018. But binding a future president involves passing a treaty that gets 2/3 of the votes in the Senate, which we all know is challenging. So my question is, is that a fair request given the recent history? And are there any creative ideas that you've heard floated for how President Biden might be able to address the Iranian concerns and get this thing done?
Well, Tommy, just to take a step back for one second, and you guys know this better than anyone because you were immersed in this when you were in government. I think it's fair to say that the decision to pull out of the nuclear agreement, it's one of the worst decisions made in recent U.S. foreign policy history.
Agreed.
Thanks to that agreement, we had Iran's nuclear program in a box, contained. We were able with great assurance because of the extensive monitoring and verification procedures that were put in, feel very confident about that. And you know, even the past previous administration said that Iran was making good on its commitments. Unfortunately, what we've seen, more than unfortunately, is since we pulled out, Iran using that as an excuse to resume many of the dangerous activities it was engaged in before the agreement, stop them from engaging those activities. And now we're at a place where after having pushed back the time it would take them to produce enough fissile material for one weapon to a year, we're now down to a matter of weeks by public record. So this is what we inherited, unfortunately. And we still think that the best outcome would be to put that program back in the box by getting back into the agreement, the so-called JCPOA. So you're right. One of the things that Iran has asked for is guarantees that we won't pull the rug out again. And you're also right that in our system, you can't provide that kind of hard and fast guarantee. President Biden can certainly say what he would or wouldn't do as president, as long as Iran remains in compliance with the agreement, but we can't bind future presidents. This is one of the things that we're talking about, but I'm obviously not going to negotiate in public, even with my close friends on the pod. We'll see where we get, but here's the reality. We have very little runway left to see if we can get back into mutual compliance, because what's happened is this, because the Iranians have restarted so many of the dangerous activities that the agreement had stopped, they are learning more, building up more knowledge, building up greater capacity to break out more quickly. And even if we return to all of the restrictions under the agreement, we're going to get to a point where we can't recapture some of the benefits of the agreement. So that's a real consideration. The other problem we have is that they are producing enough material enriched to very high levels that we're getting down to a breakout time right now that is really, really troubling. So we're working hard at this. We think it's in the interest of the United States, in the interest of allies and partners, to see if we can get back to the agreement. But I think we'll know that in the next few weeks.
So, Tony, it's kind of Groundhog Day here. We talked about Iran, now Ukraine, and you're heading out to Ukraine. And I wanted to ask you a question that gets to the value of that experience of going. You know, obviously people watch this stuff and they see readouts of phone calls and they see you shaking hands with somebody and walking into some ornate, you know, meeting space. But you've been to Ukraine a bunch over the years, I know. And I wanted to start by asking you, is there a moment you've had in Ukraine where the stakes of what they're going through really hit home to you? Like an interaction with somebody? How do you bring home for people that this is a country full of human beings under threat trying to do something hard? Like what is a moment you've had where you were standing there somewhere in Ukraine and had an interaction with somebody or something that really kind of hit home with what's at stake here?
Yeah, sure. Ben, first of all, you know, I think we all know there's no real substitute for doing things face to face, or at least mask to mask these days. You feel things, you pick up things, you get things from that kind of direct conversation that you can't get certainly on the phone and even on Zoom. So in and of itself, it's really important to be there, to listen, to watch, to pick up things. Second, one of the things that brought this home for me was one of the times I was there after the Russian invasion of 2014. I was there several times after that. I was in government then, working with both of you. And, you know, walking along the Maidan, talking to people who had been there, who stood up when this government came in and basically took away the promise that Ukrainians had voted for to be able to, have a future with Europe. And then they took to the streets peacefully to say, this is not what we want. And the snipers started at them, gunning down people, peaceful protesters, in the middle of this large, public, famous gathering place in Kyiv. But actually being there on the ground and sort of putting yourself where these people had been and looking up at the buildings where the snipers had been shooting down at them gives you a pretty palpable feel for what people had done to stand up for their own democratic right to choose the future of their country. And the other thing I'd say is this, you know, for so many of us, for many Americans, yeah, they ask the question, why are we so focused on Ukraine? Why does this matter? It's you know, half a world away. And what's so important about this? And the answer is this. Of course, Ukraine matters in and of itself. And we've been standing strongly over many years for its sovereignty, for its territorial integrity, for its independence, the formula you hear repeated endlessly. But it's also bigger than Ukraine, because what's happening is this. You've got one country, Russia, by its actions, saying that it can just change the borders of its neighbor by force, saying it can decide for its neighbor what its decisions are going to be, with whom it may choose to associate, not the people of that country through their elected government. You have a country saying it's fine to have a sphere of influence where we basically bend neighbors in our area to our will, not their own choices. And if we let that go with impunity, then I think we open a huge Pandora's box where it's not just Ukraine, it's other autocratic countries around the world like Russia that say, we're going to do this too. And that is a recipe for conflict. It's a recipe for chaos. It's a recipe for human suffering. And it's a recipe for undermining democracy. So that's why this is important. And it goes from the individuals, from that person at the Maidan, to something that actually affects Americans and people everywhere.
Well, what it's going to ask you, I mean, one of the things that's frustrating or challenging about this is that, you know, this is not something that's going to be solved, you know, even in the tenure of one president, in the sense of like Russia's not going to totally back off and Ukraine's going to totally be free to make its own choices. You're in some ways in the near term trying to prevent worse outcomes. Like the success is like a Russia doesn't invade right. this country, right? And so stepping back, Russia has done so much to shape the story in the world over the last decade through disinformation campaigns, through the Putin's force of his personality, through actions like invading piece of Ukraine. How are you guys thinking about challenging that momentum? How are we telling our story? How do we push back both against the whataboutism on Ukraine, but also this flood of disinformation? Because right now, I think the sense in the world is that the momentum is on the side of the autocratic story, whether it's emanating from Russia or China, but we're focused on Russia in this regard. How do you piece together a counter disinformation strategy, a narrative on Ukraine, and just the story that we stand for in a way that begins to push back against that Russian momentum?
You know, Ben, I think it's one of the fundamental challenges of our time. And you're right, first of all, that many of these problems, challenges are not going to be solved in one fell swoop, that sometimes success in foreign policy is preventing something even worse from happening. Sometimes success is pushing things, you know, down the road and buying time and space to see what else comes along to help you shape things in a better way. But at the same time, you're right that we have a huge challenge, particularly in the information space, the misinformation space, the disinformation space, something that we felt acutely. And it's been growing to the point where it's one of the major challenges that that we have in our own security. So, look, I think there are a number of things that we are doing, we can do, we need to be doing more of. We got to relentlessly and effectively tell our own story. So much of this is about narrative, and one of the challenges that we have is that facts and figures are one thing. Actually having a narrative, a story that resonates with people is just or maybe even more important. And so what we say, the way we say it, how we get it out there is really important. Look, we're supposed to be pretty good at narrative. So that's something that I think we ought to be able to build on. A lot of this is speaking in solidarity. With one voice. And one of the reasons that we've spent so much time the first year of this administration trying to reinvest in and reinvigorate our alliances and partnerships is precisely so on these big issues. The rest of the world hears us speaking and acting as one. And I think, you know, the last week we had these meetings at NATO, at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the European Union, others. If you were a Russian participating in those meetings or listening in on them, you would have been struck by the unity of voice, what was coming from all of our allies and partners. That doesn't just happen. It's the product of a lot of work. It's the product of building trust, confidence among us. And we've spent a lot of time and effort doing just that. So the more the, you know, the more that's happening, I think the more the prospect that we will help carry the day. And ultimately, and it's this is a big part of the challenge too. It is about trust. It's about trying to build that trust so that when you when your voice is heard, people not only listen to it, but they believe it. And that goes to much more fundamental problems about governance that we feel not only internationally outside our country, but in our country as well.
Yeah, sort of building. I mean, forgive me if my lights go out again. It's not a cyber attack. I'm sitting alone in a studio, and the lights are motion based, and sometimes they just turn off on me, and it's pitch black, which is really fun. So
you need, Tommy, you need to just keep moving.
Yeah, just gonna do this for the duration of the interview. Jumping jacks. Look, Ben and I are obsessed with this global competition that you're talking about between democracies and autocracies around the world. I know you're on Team Democracy. And that you spent a lot of time talking about why the democratic system, why democratic values are better than the alternative. But, you know, as you alluded to, you know, our democracy has been a bit of a mess lately from January 6th, the ongoing election lies. Are there times when you're abroad talking with some foreign diplomat where they say to you, like, hey, Tony, is your shit together over there? Like, is this thing going to work out? Are there times you've heard, you know, a Russian, a Chinese diplomat, some other try to undercut the U.S. system by pointing at what's going on in some of the darker recesses of our political discourse?
Absolutely. It certainly our adversaries, our opponents are very happy to point fingers at that, to try and poke at it. And indeed, they may be helping to foment it themselves, going back to what we were just talking about, with misinformation, with disinformation, with trying by various means to play on the fissures that exist in our own society. Friends, partners, allies, yeah, they might reference it more obliquely. But here's the interesting thing. It's both a challenge, but there's also, I think, some opportunity in it, because when we're asking other countries to do what may be for them hard things, politically challenging things, particularly when it comes to really strengthening their own democracies and creating the space necessary in democracies for all sorts of different groups and people to have their voice heard, to have their say. In a funny way, our own travails can be a source of strength as well as potentially as a weakness. And I mean it this way. One of the things that still sets us apart from virtually every other country is not only our ability, but our willingness and determination to confront our own challenges, our own problems openly, transparently, not trying to sweep them under the rug, not trying to pretend they don't exist. As is the case in so many other parts of the world. And so we're grappling with challenges right now, but we're doing it in an open, transparent way. And the rest of the world can see that. And it's something that I can talk about as proof positive that when we have problems that we have to confront, well, at least we're doing it openly. And, you know, you might be inspired by that to do the same thing. So in some ways, they can be helpful. But look, the bottom line is this. I think when it comes to the challenge of our time, certainly one of the challenges of our time, the face-off between democracies and autocracies, it's pretty simple on one level. We simply have to demonstrate as democracies that we can deliver in meaningful ways for what our people want. Because the argument that you hear, and you guys talk about this all the time, the argument that you hear from the autocrats is, you know what? Democracy just isn't fit for purpose for these times. It's paralyzed. It's polarized. It moves too slowly. And the great benefit of an autocracy is that it can move quickly. It can dedicate resources to whatever place it chooses without having to go through some kind of convoluted democratic process. Well, we have to prove that wrong. We have to demonstrate that when it comes to what really matters in people's lives, what they want, what they need, what they aspire to, we can respond to it and we can do it effectively. And that requires us, I think, to do that internally in our own governance and our own politics. But from my perspective and the job that I'm in, it's also more necessary than it's ever been to do that collectively, to do that together. And here's why. Look, there are lots of cliches that the three of us know very well from having worked in and out of government for a long time. But cliches usually have a kernel of truth to them. And one of them is that we simply can't deal with most of the challenges that really affect our lives alone. That the United States, for all its power, simply can't get effective results if it's doing it alone. So when you think about it, just to state the obvious, the three big things, I think, that are having more of an impact on people's lives than just about anything: COVID, climate, new technologies that are disrupting the way we do things. We can't simply deal with those effectively on our own. Climate, we're 15% of global emissions. Even if we did everything right at home, we've got to deal with the other 85%. COVID, to state the obvious, and we've been living through this once again with Omicron and the variants. Even if we managed to do everything right at home, if there's still variants circulating elsewhere, they're going to come back and bite us. We have the need, the obligation, the responsibility to work with other countries to make sure that we're beating the virus everywhere. And on emerging tech that's so both potentially powerfully positive, but also incredibly disruptive, a lot of the rules, the norms, the marketplaces for all of these things are global. They're not simply our own. So if we can't figure out a way to come together with other countries to write the rules and to shape the norms the way the technology is actually used, it may be used in ways that that we don't like, no matter what we do at home. And all of this starts with trying to build the strongest possible collection of countries that basically have the same perspective as we do, the world's other democracies. When we have that solid foundation, that solid core, there's a lot more that we can get done in the world than just the United States doing it alone. That's kind of been the foundation we've been trying to set over this first year.
It's on the tech piece, Tony, and this connects to the idea of getting our house in order at home and dealing with things abroad. I know you're bullish on I think what is a really important initiative, this US-EU Trade and Technology Council, which I think a lot of people looked at and saw as, okay, this is good. This is the US and Europe kind of sitting down and figuring things out amongst themselves, in part because we're going to be dealing with China on everything from supply chains to data privacy and security to everything else. I guess the question I had, though, is that, you know, we, I'm sure, want to talk, and there are all these working groups dedicated to standards and supply chain security, et cetera. But at the same time, we're coming to those meetings, I know from talking to Europeans, where there are a lot of concerns about U.S. technology platforms. You know, Facebook is not exactly contributing to the health of democracy around the world. There's a lot of concerns in Europe around privacy on data. When you enter into a multilateral effort like that, where on the one hand you want the eye to be focused on, you know, how is the Chinese Communist Party potentially undermining the safe and democratic uses of technology, how much are you also getting an earful about U.S. technology platforms, and what can we really do to have a kind of healthier tech ecosystem absent some agreed upon norms that may impact our technology platforms as well as preparing to deal with a growing Chinese tech sector?
Yeah, Ben, you're exactly right, and it's both. We've got obviously trade frictions with Europe. Some big ones that we've actually worked through over this past year, including a long standing issue of subsidies for the big aircraft manufacturers, as well as tariffs and so forth. But especially in the tech area too, we have some differences of approach, and we have to work through those, and we are. At the same time, there is so much more in the perspective that we bring to bear on these issues that unites us then divides us as compared to how autocracies want to regulate and rule technology. And so what I'm finding in these meetings is that even as we're working through some differences, we are seized increasingly with the notion that we have to be working together to try to do do more to shape all of these norms and rules and standards. Because if we don't, then someone else will, and that someone else will almost certainly do it in a way that's antithetical to the fundamental values that we share for democracy, for openness, for the free flow of information, for protecting people's privacy, for protecting their human rights, to make sure that technology, to the best of our ability, can be used for good things, not as a tool of repression, surveillance, you name it. So I'm finding in these conversations that, sure, the frictions are there, the differences, some differences are there. We work on them, we work through them, we've made real progress. But increasingly, there is common cause in trying to make sure that we are the ones who are kind of setting the rules for the road for the next generation.
Tony, changing gears here. So, you know, you've spoken really movingly about your stepfather's experience during the Holocaust, where he survived being held in several Nazi concentration camps. There was this horrible incident over the weekend where a man took several people hostage at a synagogue. I'm not going to ask you to get into any of the specifics of that incident, because I'm sure it's an ongoing investigation. But unfortunately, threats against synagogues or Jewish communities are happening far too often, both in the U.S. and abroad. I was curious, like, what your reaction personally is to sort of seeing these horrible things happen, and what role you think the U.S. can and should play in trying to stamp out anti-Semitism and prevent these kinds of hate crimes, both, you know, in the U.S. and around the world.
Well, I guess I'd start by saying that there is a lot of history that we all know and share, and we know throughout history that anti-Semitism, acts of anti-Semitism, violence directed against Jews, are the canary in the coal mine. And usually they augur not just bad things for Jews, but for many, many other groups until you wind up with a larger conflagration. So in and of itself, we have to be incredibly vigilant about that, whether it's in our own society or whether it's in other places around the world. And we are. We're making sure that, you know, here at home, communities, synagogues have some of the tools that they need to protect themselves, even as we're trying to deal with the larger underlying issues. And around the world, we're incredibly vigilant about reemergence of anti-Semitism, or for that matter, whether it's Islamophobia, other kinds of prejudice and violent acts directed against one group or another. But as I say, it almost always in our history has started with anti-Semitism and with acts against Jews. It's something that we're focused on, not just ourselves, but increasingly with different groups of like-minded countries who are experiencing the same things. And because of their own history, are incredibly attuned to this. But then we all have challenges in our respective politics, where sometimes these issues are used for ill, and that's something that we have to be on guard on as well.
We're gonna wrap with a few quick kind of lightning round personal questions, bridging from that very serious topic to the personal. I'm just wondering, what do your kids think you do, Tony? They're pretty small. You're gone a lot. Do they have any idea? You know, what you do. Like, what do you tell them?
So they're daddy does.
What do you tell them? They actually think you do?
So my kids are almost three and almost two. My son's almost three. My daughter's almost two. They know I go to work, whatever that is. They know I go to the State Department, whatever that is.
Well, that's
but look, here's the honest and really hard truth that I have to confront. Every once in a while, I'm on, you know, on TV, and my wife, your mutual friend, Evan Ryan, will say to my kids, "Oh, look, Daddy's on TV," and almost every time the response is, "I want Elmo, where's Sesame Street?" So I do not hold a candle to any of our fuzzy and furry friends on Sesame Street.
I imagine in a year, your kids would be like, Daddy leverages soft power around the world to advance U.S. interests.
Here's my other challenge is my son is particularly good training for doing diplomacy around the world because I ask him to do something and he says, no. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, you got to get creative. Tony, you're a musician, guitar player. You play in a band. I have deep sources within the State Department that tell me that you curate your Spotify playlist yourself, mm-hmm. even though you get accused of having someone do it for you. When are you going to pull together a musical summit, get some of your favorite bands, musicians, guitar player in the State Department, or maybe you take the show on the road, you do a world tour where you guys are just sort of rocking out for democracy or something. We can workshop that. That was terrible.
I got to say, Tommy, that could really be the final sign that we're heading for Armageddon. I'm not sure that would do anyone any good. Yeah, I've been in a series of bands over the years. I like to say that one group of guys that I played with, we never play live. We just sort of go to a recording studio and try and put down some tracks. Much like the second half of the Beatles' career, where they stopped performing live and went into the studio.
Yeah.
In their case, it was because one, you know, they couldn't hear themselves over the screaming fans, and two, the music was getting so much more sophisticated that they wanted to be in the studio. In our case, it's because no one would actually come pay to hear us play live. But nonetheless, that's kind of where we are. Look, you know, for me, we all have sort of threads in our life, and the common thread for me really has been music, something to always fall back on. And also, you know, you talked about the Spotify playlists. We've been doing those now in the countries that we're visiting. It's an incredible way to connect with people because, you know, it does bring people together. It does cross cultures. Yeah. It does cross differences. And so showing that respect and love for music from different parts of the world is a really good way of connecting. But look, if I had had a chance to pursue a career as a musician, I would have done it. I realized at an early age, there was only one thing missing. Talent.
Are you George, Paul, Lennon, Ringo? Where do you stand in the Get Back continuum? Preston?
It's a continuum. I mean, you know, there are times when you're kind of a Paul person, times when you're a John person, a George person, a Ringo person. I wouldn't want to pick or choose.
I'm going to throw one lightning one at you, which is you travel a lot. Best meal as Secretary of State and worst wake-up call as Secretary of State.
Here we go.
Okay, best meal as Secretary of State?
And we're going to say you can't say anything French because I know you don't want to cause another AUKUS kind of incident here. So we'll just rule out the French here.
Look, here's the hard part, too. Because of COVID and Omicron, when we're traveling around the world, we're generally actually not
That's brutal.
So yeah. Now I will tell you, and I know this is really dangerous because if I say one thing, pick one place, pick one country,
you got to do it.
But nonetheless, I will say this: last time I was on the job during the administration we were all part of, I think one of the greatest meals I've ever had was in Tokyo at the Tsukiji Fish Market,
nice.
Where there's an incredible hole in the wall sushi place, which is just a countertop. But it was breakfast and people line up at 5 a.m. to go to that counter and have breakfast there. And it's beyond words. Right. Hard to describe.
That's a good answer.
That's a great answer. All right, Tony, you are in a room with 100 of the most talented college seniors in the country. You have 60 seconds to pitch them on why they should join the State Department over the CIA, Wall Street, anything else. Go.
Because you can make a difference for your country, because you can do something and be part of something larger than yourself, because you can go to work every day, literally as well as figuratively, with an American flag behind your back. Because when it comes to what we've been talking about, the things that are actually having an impact on your life, on your neighbors' lives, on the lives of Americans, whether it's climate or whether it's COVID, whether it's technology, whether it's these confrontations among different powers, you can actually be in a job where you can do something about it, where you can make a difference. And even if it's only for a short time in your life, They're wonderful things to do in so many different ways in so many different pursuits. But if you can spend a little piece of your time actually being part of something that is larger than yourself, working on behalf of your fellow Americans, trying to make sure that the world is just a little bit better for us and also for our kids, in my case, something I think about every day, then you're not going to get any greater job satisfaction than that.
Ben, yeah, you sold?
I'll sign up at some point.
You think you could pass the foreign service exam?
Yeah. That's a whole other matter.
Let's not go there. Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah.
I don't know that I can do it right up. Now. I'm not sure I can swing that thing. Well, listen, Tony, I think we are over our allotted time and probably keeping you late from, you know, like high level diplomatic meetings in Ukraine designed to prevent a war. So we should probably let you go. But thank you so much for doing the show, for talking with us, for being a friend for so many years and all the great work you're doing. We really appreciate it.
Great to be with both of you. I'm a real longstanding friend of the pod, always will be. And my kids even have pod onesies. So,
yeah, that's, you know, dedication.
We're all in.
That's dedication.
Indoctrinate them early.
Start them early. Exactly. All right. Safe travels.
Thanks,
Tony.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Tony Blinken for jumping on the pod right before he jetted off to Ukraine. Hopefully this was more fun than all the work he has ahead of him.
I do wonder if the person who did the Italian job, right, is has any connection to the genius who was running the CNN live Twitter feed on New Year's Eve.
So funny.
Yeah.
So funny. When you get fooled by a fake, like, hashtag bendover name on the CNN crawl, it's always
kind of like early
laugh.
Simpsons you know, humor reflexing, you know.
I'm just a sucker for incredibly childish, stupid shit like that. Like, the Buffalo Bills fans love to throw dildos on the field for some reason.
I didn't understand that.
I don't know why they
saw that, and I wondered about that.
It's just very funny.
It felt very specific. You know, like
why Buffalo?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a Canadian influence.
Of all the stadiums that could happen, and why is it happening in Buffalo?
Yeah, why Buffalo? Yeah.
Let us know if you're
someone answer
any
this.
Buffalo worldos out there. Please let us know why this is. Why your people, you know,
why your engage, people do that.
Engage in this tradition, you know.
This tradition. It's like the masters.
Yeah. Okay. Tradition like no other.
Tradition like no other. All right, that's it for us. Right. Talk to you guys next week. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Yale Freed, and Phoebe Bradford, who film and share our episodes as videos each week.